I should be perfectly frank with all of you. I've known about this talk for half a dozen months. And it just hasn't gelled. But I have a lot of interesting information, most of which I'll remember, and we'll just see how it turns out. Because every time I try to get over the hump, I think I'm not going to worry about it. They're my friends, and they haven't seen me for a while, and maybe they'll be glad to see me. But I did think it would be fun, regardless of the subject, to begin our talk tonight with a little information about the first settlers this side of the creek. Now, I think it's impossible to know anything about the history of this area. And when I mean this, and when I say this area, I mean the Western Reserve. I don't think you can understand today unless you have some background in yesterday. And it so happens that in the Revolutionary War, the little colony of Connecticut suffered indignities and losses that were greater than those of any other colony, regardless of its size, and partly in compensation for that, and partly because her grant was from sea to sea, and she took. There's my other daughter. So I've got both daughters here tonight. She had at one time, several years before, authorized a private company to go over into the land in Pennsylvania and establish a colony in Pennsylvania the size of Connecticut. And in a court battle, she lost that privilege. So as compensation, Connecticut was allowed to stay in this country, in this area. A section beginning at the Pennsylvania border and extending westward 120 miles, or as you and I think of it tonight, just about to Sandusky. It's amazing to me the type of work and the amount of work that the first Congress did in the new nation, because they set up a plan for settling the western lands that has never been changed. We still, 1785, the land ordinance of 1785. And it provided for the rectangular survey. Before that, it had been Meads. We'll own down to that rock, or we'll go over to that oak tree. But after the rectangular survey, ranges were this way and townships were this way. In the reserve, the townships began at the Pennsylvania line, 5 miles, 5 miles, ranges. At the bottom, the 41st parallel, up. And so this area where you and I live was called Range 13, Township 7. The first settler here came with folks from Newburgh, relatives, and they started from Connecticut too late to do anything when they got here, so they stayed in Newburgh all year, all winter, and while they were there, there was a baby girl born. Now, probably some of you have read about the trips to the of the first settlers to R13, T7. And you were puzzled by the fact that sometimes they had three children and sometimes they had four. And that's the reason, because this baby girl was born. But if you want to think for a minute of what the pioneer mothers went through, you can think of coming in a wagon without springs for 40 days when you're pregnant and so near your delivery date. Well, that's another story. James Fish came across the Cuyahoga, and the only way to get from Newburgh to Brooklyn was to go all the way down to St. Clair Avenue and come across with a ferry and then come out. And if you didn't have any other mode of transportation, you walked 5 miles down, the ferry across, and 5 miles out. He came across and he built a cabin at the corner of what is today Mapledale Avenue and West 25th, and what is it now? It's Pearl Road now, isn't it? I still call it 25th. And well, bad habit. Oh, I'm sorry. There's nothing I can read. That was in May of 1812. And it was James and his wife and her mother and the three children and a newborn baby. The following year, 1813, a family came in the summertime, the Ozias Brainerd family. Four grown boys and four grown girls. Two of the boys were married and already had families. They settled on Denison Avenue at about 33rd Street. Now, some of you I know are going to wonder how she has the nerve to talk about the Brainerds. And if I get too far off the line, you'll just have to yell, no, no. But I must tell you about the Brainerds because they were such a prominent family. Now, we've talked about 1813. In 1814, in the summer, Amos Brainerd, who came with his brother, Jedediah Brainerd, and their cousin, Jabin Brainerd, not only came to R13T7, but they were the first ones to come across the creek. And they were the ones who broke the land, broke the ground on this side of the creek. In the fall of 1814, a large party came. And this is recorded many places, three or four anyway. There were 40 people. 10 horses, 6 wagons, and 6 oxen. 40 days on the way. Isaac Hinckley. Are there any Hinckleys here tonight? I understand there are still people who live on the original farm, though. Elijah Young, and incidentally, Elijah Young's piece of property was near the what is today the corner of Pearl and Broadview. And it was his property. I don't know. I never read that they sold it. Maybe he gave it to the new little village there at the corner. The rest of them were all Brainerds. Stephen and Enos Brainerd settled on what is today West 25th, near the corner of Wade. If you know anything about the neighborhood, you know that's slightly north of Clark Avenue. Stephen Brainerd settled in what was already called Brooklyn Center. No, it couldn't have been. Excuse me. And then Asa Brainerd. At that time, west of the river was part of Cleveland Township. And the officials of Cleveland just had a catnip. There was no good reason for that many people to come at the same time. There must be something wrong. And the reason that that it was wrong was because they were going to be paupers. Now, Cleveland was organized. Cleveland was already set up, the township. And that gave them the power over three things: the schools, the roads, and the poor. And the standard way of taking care of the poor was to meet them and say, "Oh, so you can't support yourself. Well, we can't either. Move on." Move on. And Alonzo Carter, who was the son of the most prominent man in the area and the person who accepted responsibility for everything, Lorenzo Carter, Alonzo Carter said, don't talk to them like that. I knew them back in Connecticut, and they're responsible people." So the six people could come over here. And as I say, Isaac Hinckley settled down on what is today Shaft Road, a mile from anybody, and everybody knew, you know, not a good place, too far away from everything. Asa Brainerd settled at the corner of what is today Scranton and Pearl. Now, I look at that map, and then I read, there's an old, old tradition that says there was an Indian trail went down through what is today Tremont. And I've never studied further, so I don't know. But my bones tell me that was the Indian Trail, Scranton Road. You know, the main road from the big east-west trail went up along the rivers, went over the oh, you know, where they carried the canoe.
The mortgage.
And today in Akron, there's a huge plaque in honor. Then it came down, what is today 21, branched off at Shaft Road to Broadview. Broadview to what is today Pearl, and Pearl north to Detroit, to the main east-west. So it was a very, very important trail. Mr. Hinckley had a time of it for a while, but he made out. And how many of you today, as you come down the new freeway and come off the Hinckley Pass on the Valley Road, think of them? And isn't it part of our duty, as saying we're interested in the Historical Society, to make that part of our ritual, to give a bow to those people who had the courage to go to an unbroken wilderness, a mile from anybody? Well, I just think about it. Now, about 1815, a relative of Lords and Barber, got this township in the draw, in the draft of 1807. And they were not able to sell anything. They had everything from the river, from the Cahoga River, 217th, I think Lakewood. And everything from the lake to Broadview, think Pearl. That's what they, except a small farm that Kelly owned down in the valley. But they couldn't sell any of it until it was, that was 1807. They couldn't sell any of it until it was surveyed. And as I told you, it had to be surveyed by a certain method and so on. They hired the staff. I tell you this because it's interesting to me how so many of these things could be absorbed. Our news is thrust at us so quickly today that we hardly know what is happening. But in 1809, September 1809, Lords and Barber had their property surveyed, and then they could be. See, and it wasn't until until 1812 that the first settlers came, because the news of the survey had to get back. The description of the area had to be told, how you were going to get there, how you were going to close up things in Connecticut, and so on. So, just think, it took 3 years to get everything done. It's interesting, isn't it? And when it filters through a little bit at a time and everybody has a chance to talk about it and to look at it, how much easier some of these things must have been. They were monumental changes, but they must have been easier to absorb than some of our news today with its rapid punching at us. About 1815, Lords and Barber put a relative, I don't know if he was a nephew, I think, but they put him in a little hut at Detroit and 25th, the Cuyahoga Trail and the Detroit Trail, Lake Trail. And I suppose today we would call him a real estate salesman. He was there to answer questions. And he was right, you see, he, just as soon as you came up the side of the Cuyahoga Valley, you saw him You might have come in on the lake trail, but you couldn't help seeing him, and you couldn't help his pitch. So I think we would call him today a real estate salesman. So anyway, also in 1815, is there anyone Greek in the group? Greek descent. I never heard this name pronounced except once. And he called it Diodati, so I don't know if that's the way you would say it or not. But Clark was the last name, Clark Avenue. And he became a very important person. He had a couple books, so he could be a teacher. And he was the first male teacher in Brooklyn. Well, as far as ACES was concerned, he had an enormous piece of property. Do you have in your picture, close your mind, close, and see the southernmost border of Riverside Cemetery? You see how far it went up. And then you see that it went from 25th Street all the way down to 14th, Jennings Road. Well, his property began at the southern end of Riverside Cemetery, and it went as far as Trowbridge. And I have a feeling, though I'm not sure of this, but I think it began at the Cuyahoga River and went west to West 39th Street. So you see, that was an enormous piece of property. He built a log cabin there at the on the point. And then that was 1814, the summer of 18, the fall of 1814. And by 1825, they had outgrown it. So he and his oldest son, whose name was Marvin, made bricks and erected the first brick house in the township. Five generations of that family lived in the house. And it was a very important place because in that house, 1825, he established the first inn in the township. Now, in those days, there were settlements, you know, gradually there were settlements. There was a settlement in North Royalton, one in Strongsville, and one in Brecksville, and so on. But if those people wanted to get to market in time, they had to leave the day before. Because don't forget how much longer it took them to go down Big Creek Valley and over the water and up. So they could not make the trip from Brecksville into the markets in one day. They had to stay overnight. And many of them stayed at the Asa Brainerd place. Asa raised his family there. One of his daughters was widowed and she came home to live with two small children. Another daughter died leaving a baby that was 10 weeks old, and that baby lived in that house. When he died, I think 1844, when Asa died, the property went to the son who'd helped him build the house, Marvin. And Marvin lived there all of his life. Marvin's oldest child was named Titus. And Titus was a real operator. He sold 103 acres to the people who wanted to begin Riverside Cemetery. And he lived well enough for the rest of his life on the proceeds of that sale. He had the two daughters who had this misfortune with their children. In addition to that, he had a daughter who married the mayor of the village, Carlos Jones. And when Marvin died, all of this property was divided. Now, imagine that. That's where Otis Steele was laid out. Down the hill and over. That's why I'm not so sure. I've never studied the steel mills that way. Well, anyway, he must have made an agreement in his will that whatever happened to the property would stay in the Asa Brainerd family. Mrs. Jones died, leaving a boy, 10, 12 years old. And her estate went to that son. So the son owned the property from 25th to 39th. And from library to Mount Marvin Avenue. The little boy died in a few years. And when he died, now this is a time, you know, the rules about how property was given were pretty strict. But the property did not go to her husband. It went to a minor. When that minor died, the property did not go to his father, Carlos Jones, but it went to his aunt and uncle. And Carlos Jones got his property from 25th to 39th and from library to Marvin. He bought that from his brother-in-law, $3,300. Isn't that interesting? How year after year, incident after incident, that the wealth of the land went back to the original family. Mr. Jones married a second time. Do any of you know where Rowley Avenue is, just this side of Clark? He married the widow of Mr. Rowley. He married Mrs. Rowley. And their farmhouse was on what was later Library Avenue. And that was a time, you know, when people had such faith in the farm. If there was anything wrong, if you could just put them in the farm where they would get plenty of fresh food and where the air would be fresh, it would all work out. And so Mr. and Mrs. Jones began to take children who were misfortunes. And they just took them for a little while. If a mother was sick and couldn't take care of her children, they would take these children for a while. If a father died and the mother had needed a little extra time to adjust, they took the children. If a child was sick and needed the fresh air of a country, they took that child. And that was the beginning of the Jones home, now Appleby. I think Jones home was. It's been other things from time to time. But when it was 100 years old, I worked with the man who looked up the history. And it was very interesting to me. There were people, adults came from all over to celebrate the 100th anniversary. And it was very touching. It was at a time when we were hearing a lot of unkind things about orphanages. And those children said, "It's home. I'm home." It was a very interesting experience. Well, anyway, you know the latest thing. Oh, I got away from my one of my daughters, Betsy C. Her initial was C, or she took the name of her mother, Clarissa, Betty Clarissa. And when she got to be the right age, she chose an up-and-coming young lawyer, Harry Farnsworth. And that is when the big house to the north of Trinity Church was built. Titus gave his daughter 90 feet on 25th, so what was at that time the turnpike, 90 feet on the turnpike going from Scranton, the 25th through to Scranton. And I'm, in my own mind, I'm sure that's when that house was built. Because I think you will all agree with me, if you just stop a minute, if you were a young woman, 25 years old, getting married to a man with a lot of promise, you would hardly want to stay at home with a widowed sister and two daughters and an orphan nephew. So I think that's when the house was built, about 1885, because she was married March 26th, I think, 1886. I must talk about Farnsworth, because I was amazed when I began to read about him. In 1916, Mayor Newton D. Baker appointed him to the first municipal planning commission. Mr. Farnsworth became interested in the idea of metropolitan parks. He was at that time a member of the Ohio legislature, and you probably know from your interest in the metro parks that because part of the parks went over into another township. Part of the metro parks went over into another township. There was no provision in Ohio law for such an organization. And so special legislation to make the metro parks possible had to be enacted and guided through the Ohio legislature. And Mr. Farnsworth was the one who did that. And when the first board of three for the metro parks was established, was, you know, the board of the metro parks is appointed by the probate judge. He was appointed chairman, and he was for a great many years the chairman of the metro parks and got the whole system started. Of course, Mr. Stinchcomb's idea, but I mean as far as the legal part of it was Harry Farnsworth. He was interested in the South Brooklyn Brooklyn Savings and Loan, the Farnsworth Building at the corner of Archwood and 25th. It was his bank. His brother-in-law was one of the chief officers. But the interesting thing they had money and they had taste. That building at the corner of 25th and Archwood is unique. It's a Dyer building. Mr. Dyer was one of Cleveland's most important architects. And it has architectural features that no other building in Cleveland has. But you see, with all that money and all that land, they really knew how to spend it, didn't they? It's interesting. Well, I digress. However, the house remained in the name of Mrs. Farnsworth. And the house remained in the hands of the Mrs. Farnsworth until she died. And then Mr. Farnsworth got it. Now he was not only a lawyer, he was in the real estate business. And when he died in 1957, the property was up for sale. They had two sons, and one of them must have died young. I don't see any record of them. And the other was Brainerd Farnsworth, who was the councilman for quite some time. And apparently Brainerd died early too, because I don't see anything when I'm my reading. I don't. If anybody knows, I'd be glad to have you set me right. But at any rate, the boys didn't get it. It went up on the market for sale, and it was bought by the Orthodox Church. And they built a church on Scranton Road. And they took the house for a parish house. And, where the priests lived.
Parsonage?
And I don't know how long ago it was, say 2 or 3 years, that church moved. And it's now standing vacant. But that's the story of the first. Oh, it's not all of the story. After there was no more Farnsworth living in the brick house, and it was occupied for most of a century. The old brick house was a rooming house, and it was a boarding house, And you know, every time it changed, it went down a little bit. And there were some, on the Scranton Road, there was a four-suite apartment house. So you couldn't see the old brick house at all. It was covered up. And on the 25th Street side, there was a group of old nondescript one-and-a-story business blocks. So you couldn't see the old stone house. Finally, it was a restaurant, and there was an annex built. And after a while, Trinity Church used that annex for some 12 years, I think, and then when they built their educational wing, it was torn down. And in 1825 to 1937, the old stone house, the old brick house, was torn down. And I like to think that since 1937, there's been such an increase in the interest of restoration, that today, the first brick house in Brooklyn Township would have to stand. But in 1937, you know, we didn't feel that way, so it was torn down.
Are you aware, Ruth, that Applewood bought the church? Applewood has bought the church and the remaining house?
Applewood has purchased the house. Mm-hmm. Has the work begun yet?
Oh, yes, it's finished.
No. Not the restoration. They work with the boys.
Oh yes, they're living in there. It's for
they're living in there.
Teenagers.
For those
about
of you who may not remember,
teaching them independent living.
Yes, these boys who have been on relief when they face it's age 16. They've been one house or one home or another most of their lives, and they don't have any idea. So they're taught how to go on a bus, how to pay a bus fare, how to buy their bus, how to buy enough meals, enough cooking so they know how to cook for themselves. In other words, they're taught their activities of daily living, so that when they get to be 16, they will have some way of knowing how to adjust to the big world. And it's very badly needed. And as I understand it, they're going to have a period when they're through with that. They're going to have a period where they'll live in two or three of them will live together in an apartment house, supporting themselves and using what they have found out. And as I understand it, eventually there will be a similar facility for girls.
And they're putting it out at age 16?
I don't hear you.
At age 16, they're putting it out?
16. 16 is the age when age-dependent children stops. See, these are children who have been wards of the county. And meanwhile, Appleby is still doing some of the rehabilitation work in the Jones home.
Those children from Jones home went to Dennis's school. I went to school with them.
Now, I think that about uses up my time, doesn't it? And, you know me, if you gave me another chance, I could begin and do that.